Good afternoon, Tri-States. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And this is Ken reading from the Friday, March 5th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And remember that IRIS is brought to you in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. And now our first piece from Above the Fold. Marijuana dispensary gets ready to roll in Galena. And we have a large picture of two young people in masks. And beneath the caption, and there, between them, there is the name Verilife, V-E-R-I-L-I-F-E. Davina Capolupo, Verilife District Manager for Illinois, and Bill McAnamy, President of Verilife, on Thursday prepare the Verilife Recreational Marijuana Dispensary to open in Galena, Illinois, on Saturday, March 6th. 1 year ago, Verilife President Bill McAnamy was scoping out Galena for a new marijuana dispensary. Pharmacon, which operates dispensaries under the brand name Verilife, now is readying to open a recreational dispensary downtown on Saturday, March 6th. The business occupies a former bank building, which on Thursday bore Verilife signs draped down the exterior wall. Customers age 21 or older can buy products at the dispensary as long as they provide a government-issued ID, such as a driver's license or passport. Verilife follows all Illinois law regarding marijuana sales and use since it was legalized in the state January 1, 2020, McAnamy said. Illinois residents can purchase up to 30 grams of cannabis in flower form or 500 milligrams of edibles per state law. Non-Illinois residents can purchase up to 15 grams of cannabis flower or 250 milligrams of edibles. Verilife dispensaries use an online reservation system to ensure products are available, McAnamy said. Customers can select their products online and set a time to pick them up and pay at the business. It's like a mobile ordering system at Starbucks, he said. You just reserve your product, and you can reserve products up to 48 hours in advance. Customers will first enter a lobby area to have their ID scanned so they can enter the rest of the dispensary to pick up their products and pay. McAnamy said people can pay with cash, ATMs are located on site, or via a web-based app called Spence. He said there's also flexibility for people shopping in downtown Galena who decide to walk in and buy products. Walk-in customers can consult with staff on products in which they are interested, and an employee can set a nearly immediate reservation time. Staff scan IDs again when customers pay for their product as an extra security measure, McAnamy said. The dispensary will offer a wide variety of cannabis products, though Davina Capolino, Verilife District Manager for Illinois, noted that flowers, chews, and vapes are the biggest sellers. Consuming or using any of the products at the dispensary is prohibited, McAnamy said. Illinois law states that marijuana products can be used in private homes. However, customers purchasing recreational marijuana who live in Iowa or Wisconsin cannot bring the products across state lines. McAnamy said Galena had everything his company was looking for in its westernmost location in Illinois. All of Verilife's other Illinois stores, including two new ones set to open later this year, are in the Chicago area. The dispensary is also following COVID-19 health and safety protocols, he noted. All employees will wear both a mask and a face shield, and surfaces will be sanitized every half hour. The desk in the lobby also has a plexiglass barrier. Capolupo said the Galena store has 45 employees, most of whom are local. She added that staff have all been thoroughly educated on products and regulations, as customers often have a lot of questions when coming into a dispensary. McAnamy also said Verilife likes to lend a hand in its community in any way possible, such as park cleanups and assisting with food giveaways. We're incredibly excited to join the Galena community and to be able to provide jobs and driving revenue, McEnany said. Galena has 1 million visitors per year, so this was a good location for us. Our goal is just to be able to serve the community. And our second piece, also from above the fold, prices at pump surge, but will they accelerate? Gasoline prices in the tri-state area have shot up recently, and analysts for a leading fuel tracking service on Thursday predicted that they could climb to $3 per gallon by Memorial Day. An area economics professor said he doesn't anticipate such a jump, however. What's undisputed is the recent surge in prices in the area. Fuel tracking service Gas Buddy reported as of Thursday night that the average fuel price in the Dubuque metropolitan area had risen by about 20 cents in the previous month and more than 55 cents from 2 months earlier. Tanya Dume, who works at Neighborhood Quick Mart on West Locust Street in Dubuque, has seen gas prices continue to rise in the past few weeks. I know it's been increasing like every 2 or 3 days. Prices are just nuts. Prices bottomed out last April and early May, with the Dubuque area average dipping to less than $1.50 per gallon as demand withered during the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic and more people stayed at home. Those prices ended up being a great benefit for consumers, but it was actually an indication of horrific stress in the economy, said Dave Swenson, an Iowa State University economist. Because the prices were so low, oil rigs were shut down. But some trends are reversing. We've had several months of a growing economy, and the pandemic is easing some as people are getting their vaccines, Swenson said. Motor vehicle fuel demand is up, but the supply is lagging. The key factor in recently higher U.S. gas prices has been the February storms that have taken refineries offline, tightening supply. The national average was $2.74 per gallon on Thursday, up more than 30 cents from the beginning of February. The run-up was a function of refinery and distribution disruptions from the southern freeze, Swenson said. Even though we get most of our gas from North Dakota and Canada, problems in one petroleum region often affect our prices as well. Gas Buddy analysts on Thursday predicted that prices would continue to climb, topping $3 per gallon on average nationally by Memorial Day, the highest average price since 2014. The prediction came after the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries' recent meeting ended without any decisions to increase production. The outcome of today's OPEC meeting lends to a running of the bulls in oil markets, as global oil demand rebounds amidst recovery in the COVID-19 pandemic, while OPEC, which controls a third of global production, balks at the recovery and maintains extreme production cuts, said Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy, in a press release. Swenson, however, said he does not foresee prices reaching $3 per gallon. He expected steadily rising prices to incentivize domestic oil producers to boost production and meet demand, causing prices to level off. This is good news for domestic producers because it gives them the kind of prices that support increased production, he said. This is way different than the way it was 15 years ago. Now, OPEC making a decision on this has a minor short-term effect. We produce so much domestically because of fracking. We are so much less dependent on imports. As of last week, gas production was up one-third from April 2020, but remains about 20% below pre-pandemic production levels, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Danny Ling, energy marketing manager at Three Rivers FS, which owns several local gas stations, said gas and diesel sales at the business's Dyersville, Iowa location were up 10% last month compared to the same time last year, and with sales up 25% in Manchester, Iowa. "Our numbers are starting to come back," she said. Swenson, meanwhile, said he expects gas prices to level off at around $2.50 per gallon in the U.S. "What's going on is simply the adjustment to the pandemic," he said. "The people that sell and produce oil want nothing more than to sell that oil, but they can't do it until the demand's up. Supply is going to lag demand for a while." Our third and final piece from the front page, event to benefit Joe Davies County woman hurt in crash, from Stockton. We have an inset picture both of the young lady, Cassandra Davies, and a picture of the crash she was involved in. It's a semi-trailer, a white semi-trailer, with a telephone pole leaning on it and the whole front end of the trailer rig mangled. And it says beneath it, in a crash on January 25th outside Norfolk, Virginia, Cassandra Davies of Woodbine, Illinois, was injured after this semi-tractor trailer went into a ditch and hit a telephone pole. And our article? After a Joe Davies County woman suffered extensive injuries in a crash earlier this year, community members are coming together to aid her family as she recovers. Cassandra Davies, 25, of Woodbine, was riding in a semi-tractor trailer with her boyfriend on January 25th outside of Norfolk, Virginia, when the truck left the roadway on a sharp corner, went into a ditch, and hit a telephone pole, ejecting Cassandra from the vehicle. Her father, Ken, said she broke her back, neck, and multiple ribs, as most of the crash impact was on Cassandra's side of the vehicle. "It was kind of a miracle that she survived," he said. "Her lungs were collapsed on the scene, and the first person who stopped was an EMT that had the stuff with him to keep her breathing until the ambulance showed up. It could have been very different." Cassandra was treated for 1 month in Centara Norfolk General Hospital, her father said. She underwent multiple surgeries and spent most of her time in the intensive care unit. "She was on a respirator for quite a while," Ken said. "It took quite a while for her lungs to recover from the bruising and the damage. It was kind of one of the biggest steps. They did an amazing job. It's a real high-ranked place. She couldn't have been anywhere better." While Cassandra still has numerous doctor appointments and plenty of rehabilitation ahead of her, she was able to come home with her father on February 25th. Ken is now her primary at-home caregiver. To help cover some of the expenses stemming from the crash, such as Ken missing a month of work to stay in Virginia, several of his lifelong friends and other community members have organized a benefit for the family this weekend. The benefit, sponsored by Raisbeck Painting, Laurie's Painting, and Chubb's Pub and Grub, will culminate with a live music performance on Saturday, March 6th. Attendees can donate funds or place bids on a silent auction that wraps up Saturday. Tara Gertz, owner of Chubb's Pub and Grub, said she has 10 big baskets of items ready for the silent auction. She noted that Ken Davies sometimes plays guitar in a band at the restaurant. "He's the type of person that would help anybody out, so we thought we should help him out," she said. Ken said he has received many messages from people wanting to help after his daughter's accident. A GoFundMe page for the Davies family had raised $1,690 as of Thursday afternoon. "It's amazing the amount of people reaching out," he said. "We're very thankful. We're still in this and trying to sort it out and trying to get there. So we're super thankful and just can't believe the people that are reaching out." Ken said his daughter has remained in good spirits throughout her recovery process, and her nurses in the hospital were surprised by her attitude and strength. Cassandra was able to go outside the house once this week to enjoy the warmer weather, he said, though her energy levels vary. "Actually, you know, she's doing as well as can be expected," he said. "She's still got a long road to recover. It'll be nice to be normal again." And an inset on how to help. Those wishing to participate in the benefit for Cassandra Davies can bid on silent auction items or bring cash donations to Chubb's Pub and Grub, 120 East Main Street in Warren, Illinois, today and Saturday, March 6th. Local band Problem Child will play at the restaurant at 8 p.m. Saturday. People with questions about the benefit can contact Betsy Raisbeck, 815-947-6007, or Tara Gertz, 815-745-3333. Other donations can be given at gofundme.com/f/parents-of-Cassandra-Davies. You probably would best just call the phone number to get the other information. Again, those two numbers, 815-947-6007 or 815-745-3333. Now we turn to news from the Dubuque area. Three additional local deaths related to virus. Three additional related deaths were reported in the Telegraph Herald's 10-county coverage area between 5 p.m. Wednesday and 5 p.m. Thursday. One new death was reported in Dubuque County, raising the county's death toll to 195. One additional death was reported in Jones County, Iowa, increasing the county's death toll to 55. One new death was reported in Iowa County, Wisconsin. The county's death toll increased to 10. As of 5 p.m. Thursday, Dubuque County had a 14-day positivity rate of 3.6%. Rates for other area counties in Iowa included Clayton County, 1%, Delaware, 1.6%, Jackson County, 2.8%, and Jones County, 2%. Iowa provided new county-level hospitalization data Thursday. The figures as of Wednesday afternoon showed that 12 Dubuque County residents with COVID-19 were hospitalized, one less than Tuesday's data. Also hospitalized were two Jackson County residents, unchanged from Tuesday, and one Jones County resident, unchanged from Tuesday. No such residents of Clayton or Delaware counties were hospitalized as of Wednesday. As of 5 p.m. Thursday, no local long-term care facilities were on the state's outbreak list. Statewide, Iowa reported 582 additional COVID-19 cases for a total of 338,268. The state reported 35 additional related deaths, so the toll rose to 5,536. As of 5 p.m. Thursday, statewide, 559,997 residents had received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine. 208,429 were fully vaccinated. A COVID-19 vaccination clinic is scheduled in Maquoketa at Pearson Hall today. Appointments for a first dose of the vaccine can be scheduled by visiting osterhauserx.com/COVID-19-information. Let me spell this out again. I think it's a very important site for those in that area. It's O-S-T-E-R, Oster, H-A-U-S, House, R-X, dot, C-O-M, backslash, COVID, C-O-V-I-D, dash, 19, dash, information. A new COVID-19 vaccine hotline is now available in Wisconsin. In addition to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services vaccine webpage, residents can now call for assistance with registration and ask questions related to the vaccine and vaccination locations. The number residents can call is 844-684-1064. That number again for Wisconsin residents, 844-684-1064. A free COVID-19 testing site will be open in Platteville, Wisconsin today, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the National Guard Armory, 475 North Water Street. Appointments are not required, but visitors are encouraged to pre-register at register.covid-19.com covidconnect.wi.gov. Again, register.covidconnect.wi.gov. Wisconsin reported 677 additional statewide cases as of 5 p.m. Thursday, raising the state's total to 565,808. There were 12 additional deaths reported, raising the toll to 6,470. Wisconsin also reported 986,387 residents had received at least one dose of vaccine, 16.9% of the state's population. Statewide, Illinois reported an additional 1,740 cases, increasing the total to 1,193,260. The state reported 42 additional related deaths, increasing the toll to 20,668. Illinois also reported 1,904,282 residents had received at least one dose of the vaccine, and 952,141 were fully vaccinated. As of 5 p.m. Thursday, 57,679 residents in the Telegraph Herald's 10-county coverage area have had at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, 19.1% of the area's population. And we have another related article on vaccination. It is Iowa to start vaccinating people who have certain conditions. Vaccinations of people younger than 65 with certain medical conditions will start next week in Iowa. The Iowa Department of Public Health announced Thursday night that effective Monday, March 8th, vaccinations can start for adults younger than 65 with medical conditions that are or may be an increased risk of severe illness from COVID-19. The state will use the Federal Center for Disease Control and Prevention's list of conditions that qualify. They can be viewed at, this is a long one, https://bit.ly/numeral3, small k, capital K, small n, capital T, small d, capital O. But the list includes, I think this is probably an easier way of seeing if you qualify, asthma, moderate to severe, cancer, cerebrovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, cystic fibrosis, Down syndrome, heart conditions such as heart failure, coronary artery disease or cardiomyopathies, hypertension or high blood pressure, immunocompromised state from solid organ transplant, blood or bone marrow transplant, immune deficiencies, HIV, use of corticosteroids or use of other immune-weakening medicines, liver disease, neurologic conditions such as dementia, obesity and severe obesity and overweight, pregnancy, pulmonary fibrosis, sickle cell disease, smoking, thalassemia, type 1 diabetes mellitus, type 2 diabetes mellitus. The Iowa Department of Public Health stated that some counties report that they are nearly done with vaccinating previous priority groups. Some counties and vaccine providers will remain focused on previously prioritized populations until they are closer to completion, a press release states. Because vaccine production has not fully met the demand for vaccine, Iowans will need to remain patient as vaccine production increases. The White House announced this week that by the end of May, there will be enough vaccine for anyone over the age of 16 to receive a vaccination. Now we turn to our opinion page and our view, the Friday Quick Takes. And we have three of them, one frowny and two smiley faces. And our first one's the frowny. Iowans must object to discouraging 1619 project in schools. It's one thing for community leaders to discuss and even debate what works best to help illuminate history and what should be used to support school curriculum. It's another thing entirely for the heavy hand of the state legislature to threaten to withhold money from school districts that opt to include particular works to supplement curricula. That's precisely what's happening in Iowa, where House of Representatives File 222 says districts would receive less funding based on the number of days the 1619 project was used in classrooms, claiming the project attempts to deny or obfuscate the fundamental principles upon which the United States was founded. To be clear, the 1619 Project is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalism that mines history for rarely told stories and historical facts about the history of slavery in this country. It's not meant to be a textbook, but a supplement and an eye-opening conversation starter. Isn't that, after all, the kind of thought-provoking, critical thinking subject matter we want kids to discuss at school? The 1619 Project underscores the point that white settlers and business people earned fortunes on the labor of enslaved black people. Not an easy subject matter to reckon with, but precisely the kind that prompts conversations that can bridge understanding in the next generation. Iowa isn't the only state contemplating keeping this work of journalism out of schools. But Iowans should stand up and cry foul as lawmakers consider withholding school funding for the transgression of instigating serious discussion of America's deeply rooted racial strife. Our second quick take, a smiley face. If Iowa lawmakers really want to do something to help schools provide a better student experience, they could give teachers and administrators some relief in the form of loosening requirements for substitute teacher authorization. A bill in the legislature would allow those with an associate's degree or at least 60 undergraduate semester hours to receive substitute authorization for any grade instead of the currently required bachelor's degree. The change would coincide with a temporary change that Governor Kim Reynolds put in place last summer to help alleviate school districts' staffing struggles as teachers got sick with COVID-19 or were quarantined. The change helped schools ensure staffing needs are met at a time when substitute teachers have been highly difficult to secure. Here's a good opportunity for lawmakers to come together, regardless of party, in support of schools and students. Easing restrictions on substitute teacher credentials could help keep school systems running smoothly with a bigger reservoir of backups. And our third and final smiley face? Southwest Wisconsin residents and other interested parties can voice opinions about the state's new redistricting maps now through Thursday, March 11th. This is the time to weigh in on the process that could impact the state congressional seats for the next decade. This is Wisconsin's chance to emulate Iowa's fair and unbiased district maps. After each new decade's census is tallied, states must establish new state legislature and congressional districts that take into consideration shifts in population. In Iowa, nonpartisan legislative staffers draw the maps without considering party affiliations indicated on voter registration rolls. The main consideration is keeping the districts compact and uniform in population. That's not the case in Wisconsin, Illinois, or numerous other states. In many other places, drawing new maps is a wholly political endeavor meant to preserve safe seats, where the re-election of incumbents is practically guaranteed. That can lead to complacency, pork barrel spending, and a lack of accountability. In Iowa, there are no safe seats. This year, the Badgers could take a lesson from the Hawkeye State. Governor Tony Evers has charged the People's Map Commission with drawing new redistricting maps using a nonpartisan process. The virtual hearing in this area's 2nd Congressional District will be held on Thursday, with written comments accepted in advance. Help put an end to gerrymandering in Wisconsin and make your views known at govstatus.egov.com/peoplesmaps/hearings-meetings. We have one letter to the editor today. Iowa elections bill would reform a system that works well. From Brendan Kwan, South Grandview Avenue. In regard to the February 19th lead TH story, Iowa GOP Advances Elections Bill, I noted the periods for in-person voting and mail-in early voting would both be reduced from 29 to 18 days. The period within which to request an absentee ballot would be reduced by 50 days, as well as other restrictions and limitations. This following a record 1.7 million Iowans voting in the 2020 presidential election without a single incident of voter fraud in the state. A million of these voters cast their votes by absentee ballot. Opposition to the bill in eastern Iowa is bipartisan. The Iowa State Association of County Auditors, which represents election commissions in all 99 counties and has a Republican president, opposes it. It is opposed by disabilities rights groups, AARP, labor unions, the League of Women Voters, the American Civil Liberties Union, etc., etc. And the purpose of this election bill is? And three question marks follow it. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio and Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, supported in part by the DePaco R.W. Hafer Foundation. I'm Ken, continuing our reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, and we now turn to today's obituaries. Judith M. Ellery, Sherrill, Iowa. Judith May Ellery, 77, of Sherrill, passed away March 1st at home, surrounded by her loving family. A visitation will be held from 10 a.m. until 12 p.m. on Saturday, March 6th at First Congregational United Church of Christ. A funeral service will follow at noon, with Reverend Dr. Lillian Daniel officiating. A live stream of the funeral service will be on the church Facebook page. Please enter the church through Locust Street entrance. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, is assisting the family. Judith May Ellery Miller was born September 19, 1943, in San Jose, California, to Leonard and Geraldine Frith Miller. She married Ronald Lee Ellery August 29, 1964, at St. Luke's United Methodist Church. Judy worked at Flexsteel, Oak Ridge Athletics, Northwest Fabrics, and LT Amusements. She was a member of TOPS, St. Luke's Choir, Quilters Club, Girl Scout Leadership, Recovery, and was a longtime bowler. Judy was an amazing wife, mother, daughter, grandmother, and friend. Judy's family always came first, and she truly believed that family was not just blood. She was an accomplished seamstress. She loved to quilt, embroider, knit, and swim. Judy was an avid reader and spent countless weekends camping and square dancing with family and friends. She loved with her whole heart. Memorials in Judy's name may be given to Hospice of Dubuque and Shriners. Joyce L. Becker. Joyce L. Becker, 92, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, March 3rd. Visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday, March 7th, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service, 3860 Asbury Road. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, March 8th, at St. Columbkill Catholic Church in Dubuque. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Richard N. Hoffman, Platteville. Richard N. Hoffman, 87, of Platteville, died Tuesday, March 2nd. A funeral service will be held at 6 p.m. Tuesday, March 9th at Casey McNett Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Dubuque, or in Cuba City, rather, in Cuba City, where a public visitation will be held from 4 to 5:45 p.m. Lawrence J. Rosenthal. Lawrence J. Rosenthal, 82, of Dubuque, died on Thursday, March 4th. No visitation or services will be held. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, is assisting the family. Walter W. Heisler, Epworth. Walter W. Wally Heisler, 82, of Bankston, Iowa, passed away Tuesday, March 2nd at Mercy One, Dubuque, Iowa. Visitation will be held 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 6th at St. Clement Catholic Church in Bankston. Masks and social distancing will be required. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 6th at St. Clement Catholic Church in Bankston, with burial in the church cemetery. Reverend Scott Boone will officiate. Funeral services will be live-streamed on St. Elizabeth Pastorate Facebook page at 11 a.m. Walter was born February 14, 1939, in Bankston, Iowa, the son of Charles and Rose Sherbring Heisler. Wally grew up on a farm near Bankston. He worked at Armstrong Lumber in Dyersville for several years. He then was the St. Clement Parish custodian until retirement. In lieu of flowers, please make memorials to St. Clement Parish or Divine Word College. Information available at www.kramerfuneral.com. Cards may be sent to the family in care of Kramer Funeral Home, 750 12th Avenue Southwest, Dyersville, Iowa, 52040. And we have for our new arrivals, again, like yesterday, just one, Wednesday, March 3rd, Hillard, Matt and Olivia Hillard of Dubuque, a boy at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. And we welcome this little guy to our fold. Now we continue with a bit of news from the tri-states. And we have an inset picture of a large American Eagle plane. Well, large for our area, anyway. And beneath it, it says an American Eagle jet pulls up to the terminal at the Dubuque Regional Airport last August. But our article, another Chicago flight returning to Dubuque. A second Dubuque to Chicago flight will return 5 days per week in April, providing an encouraging sign that the aviation industry is inching closer to normalcy. Beginning April 2nd, the new flight will arrive at Dubuque Regional Airport at 10:13 a.m. and depart at 10:47 a.m. on Monday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So it's kind of like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Nothing on Tuesday and Wednesday. Anytime we can add service, it is a plus, said Airport Director Todd Dalsing. That means more seats out of Dubuque and more possibilities for connections. It gives people more options. Molly Grover, President and CEO of Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce, believes the return of a second flight is an indication that the economy as a whole is gaining momentum. It is encouraging news, and it provides hope that we might be getting closer to a post-pandemic economy, she said. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, American Airlines offered 3 daily flights that traveled from Dubuque to Chicago and vice versa. Since the pandemic hit the U.S., major airlines have been propped up largely by federal stimulus dollars. In turn, airlines were prevented from making job cuts and required to maintain service. After the first major relief bill expired, however, Dubuque commercial flights to Chicago were suspended for about 3 months beginning in early October. A new relief package prompted the resumption of those flights at Dubuque Regional Airport on January 6th. The airport since has had 1 daily flight departing from Dubuque to Chicago each morning and returning to Dubuque each night. Dalsing said, The addition of a second flight was not prompted by a specific stimulus bill or related requirements. Rather, it was a market-driven indication that the aviation industry is rebounding. "We have had some of our flights sold out and booked with no more seats available," he said. "I think the decision by American Airlines is about seeing an increase in passenger demand and wanting to fill up airplanes." At the beginning of the pandemic, flights were down more than 90% nationally compared to the prior year. Dalsing said flights nationally still are down about 60%, but all signs are pointing in a positive direction. The number of passengers screened by the Transportation Security Administration each day, a reliable metric for how many people are flying in the U.S., is now exceeding 1 million. To date, the return of flight demand largely has been driven by leisure travel. Dalsing believes that business travel will take longer to rebound. Even so, Grover said the addition of a second flight is big news for the business community. "Air travel is imperative to our businesses, their growth, their ability to connect to markets, and their continued success," she said. Dalsing said the second flight will continue to operate through April. As is typically the case with flight schedules, the flight plans of American Airlines are not set in stone beyond that month. "They are always reviewing flight schedules, and they'll continue to evaluate that on a month-to-month basis," he said. We'll now continue with bits and pieces throughout of our news in brief. Jackson County farmer fined for a second time by DNR, Miles, Iowa. A Jackson County farmer has been fined again, this time for $5,000, for failing to plant trees and shrubs as required by an agreement. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources this week released details of the latest penalty against Roger Kilberg. An administrative order states that Kilberg runs a confinement feeding operation with 1,800 heads of cattle at 11483 500th Avenue in Miles. In September 2015, the DNR issued a construction permit allowing the expansion of the facility by 1,000 head. As part of getting approval, Kilberg agreed to plant, maintain, and replace trees and shrubs at the site. A DNR representative contacted Kilberg in January 2019 about the plantings, and Kilberg said they would be complete by June 1 of that year. On June 10, Kilberg told the DNR that he had not started planting yet. On October 9, 2019, a DNR representative visited the site and saw that the expansion had been populated with cattle, but that no trees or shrubs had been planted. Days later, the DNR issued a notice of violation. An administrative order issued in July 2020 required Kilberg to plant trees and shrubs by December 1 and to pay a penalty of $3,000. The DNR reports that while Kilberg signed a consent order and paid the fine, he did not complete the required plantings. A new order fines him $5,000 and requires that the trees and shrubs be planted by July 1 of this year. You would think that he'd plant the trees and save the money from the fines. Next piece. Two hurt in two-vehicle crash in Dubuque. Two people were injured in a two-vehicle crash Monday in Dubuque. Gail P. Springer, 59, of Dubuque, was transported by ambulance to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center, and Kenneth M. Rigdon, 56, of Asbury, was transported by private vehicle to Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital for treatment of their injuries, according to police. The crash occurred at about 5:10 p.m. Monday on Dodge Street near its intersection with the Northwest Arterial. Police said vehicles driven by Springer and Rigdon were headed west on Dodge Street. Rigdon's vehicle was stopped in traffic when Springer's vehicle rear-ended it. Springer was cited with failure to maintain control of a vehicle. Donations accepted for annual Shop with a Cop. Donations are being accepted to support the annual Dubuque Police Department Shop with a Cop program. Held by the Dubuque Police Protective Association, the bargaining unit for Dubuque police officers, In conjunction with Key Services, the program features officers purchasing back-to-school clothing and supplies for area children. Last year's in-person shopping event was postponed because of COVID-19, but program organizers were able to purchase $3,000 worth of winter coats and hats for children, according to a press release. The coats and hats were delivered in January to St. Mark Youth Enrichment for distribution. The release states that while cash donations are accepted, donors are encouraged to make checks out to Dubuque Police Protective Association. Donations can be delivered to the Dubuque Law Enforcement Center, 770 Iowa Street. Solicitors from Key Services also will provide instructions on how to donate. Donations will be accepted through August. More information is available by contacting Association Board Member Nick Schlosser at nschloss@cityofdubuque.org, or better yet, the phone number 563-587-3813. 563-587-3813. FlexSteel declares quarterly dividend. The Board of Directors of Dubuque-headquartered FlexSteel Industries this week declared a quarterly dividend of 15 cents per share. It is payable March 29th to shareholders of record as of March 17th, according to a press release. The announcement marks the 317th consecutive quarterly cash dividend. The company is a designer, manufacturer, importer, and marketer of upholstered and wood furniture for the residential, recreational vehicle, office, hospitality, and healthcare markets. Clayton County Courthouse to reopen Monday. From Elkader. The Clayton County Courthouse will reopen Monday, March 8th. Social distancing and mask requirements will remain in effect at the facility in Elkader. The facility will also follow maximum occupancy rules. Oh, we have two other small articles I passed over on the Dubuque page. I forgot about them. Here's our first one. City manager requests Office of Shared Prosperity. The Dubuque City's manager is requesting to hire three employees to head the creation of a new city office aimed at alleviating local poverty. The proposed Office of Shared Prosperity would be responsible for the recently approved Equitable Poverty Reduction and Prevention Plan and would coordinate with local nonprofits on poverty reduction initiatives and collect data on poverty in the community. City staff presented the hiring proposal to City Council members this week during a budget hearing session. In order to create the office, City Manager Mike Van Milligan recommended that council members approve hiring a director for the new office, along with a data analyst and secretary. The city also would shift the existing community engagement coordinator position, currently in the Human Rights Department, to the Office of Shared Prosperity. In order to create an equitable community of choice for all members of our community, we must look at key performance indicators of community well-being and success and disaggregate them, take them apart, to ensure that all groups are experiencing the same positive outcomes, Van Milligan wrote in a memo to City Council members. To reduce the costs of creating the new office, city staff would alter the existing neighborhood development specialist position, which is currently vacant, to include the duties of directing the new department. The data analyst and secretary positions, however, would require the city to spend an additional $102,355 to hire employees to fill them. The budget recommendation states that the new office would be located in an existing city facility, with plans to eventually relocate it to the former fire station building near the intersection of Central Avenue and 18th Street. Dubuque City Council members have previously shared their support for the creation of the new city office. Councilmember Brad Kavanaugh said following the budget hearing that the community's fight to reduce and prevent poverty requires a coordinated effort led by the city. There needs to be a central hub where the fight against poverty would be, Kavanaugh said. It's a matter of making sure we are sharing in the prosperity throughout the community and making sure nobody is falling behind. Councilmember Laura Russell also expressed support for the new office following the meeting, saying the city could ensure that local efforts from nonprofit organizations to fight poverty are not going to waste. We have lots of great people doing a lot of great things, but there is a lot of redundancy among these organizations and a lot of confusion for people trying to utilize those services, Russell said. With this new office, we can know that we are on the right track. And our other piece that I overlooked, two accused of robbery at knife point. Two men have been charged after police said they robbed a Dubuque resident at knife point. Cameron M. Gallagher, 18, of 259 Valeria Street, was arrested at 1:34 p.m. Wednesday in the area of East 20th and White Streets on charges of possession of marijuana and of drug paraphernalia, as well as a warrant charging first-degree robbery. Jaden A. Johnson, 18, of Savannah, Illinois, was arrested at 3:51 p.m. Wednesday at Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on a warrant charging first-degree robbery. Court documents state that Gallagher and Johnson robbed Zachary A. Tittle, 26, of 2044 White Street, number 4, shortly before 11 a.m. Sunday at Tittle's residence. Documents state that Gallagher knocked at the door and displayed a small knife, pulling Tittle out of the apartment and onto the ground. Johnson then held Tittle down while Gallagher punched Tittle in the face. Gallagher then entered the apartment and stole a blanket and other items, according to court documents. Police said Gallagher and Johnson fled the scene on foot. Traffic camera footage tracked them to running into or onto Jackson Street. Gallagher and Johnson were spotted Wednesday walking on the 1800 block of White Street. Gallagher was arrested, and Johnson voluntarily agreed to visit police for an interview. Gallagher told authorities that he and Johnson had gone to the apartment to purchase marijuana and argued with Tittle over the price. And returning now to our news in brief, Dubuque student, one of two Iowans, picked for Senate Youth Program. A Dubuque student is one of two Iowans selected for the U.S. Senate Youth Program. Jillian Matternack, a senior at Dubuque Senior High School, will join U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst representing Iowa in the program's 59th annual Washington Week, scheduled for March 14th to the 17th, according to a press release. Nationwide, 104 high school students were selected for the program, two from each state, Washington, D.C., and the Department of Defense Education Activity. At Senior, Matternack is treasurer of the student body, president of National Honor Society, secretary of Key Club, and a Model United Nations delegate. She is also a representative to the Iowa Youth Congress and a member of the varsity soccer team and volunteers in her community and nationally. To me, sounds like a wonderful choice. Finally, our weekend buzz. Becoming an Outdoor Woman, Saturday, Swiss Valley Nature Preserve and Nature Center, 13606 Swiss Valley Road, 9:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. Join Dubuque County Conservation and Dubuque Land Pheasants Forever for the day. Activities include presentations from local female outdoor experts, campfire cooking, knot tying, and a local female Ironman athlete who will discuss the how-to for getting into triathlons. Come prepared for being outside for a session around a campfire. Donation is recommended for lunch. Register, and there's a whole bunch of stuff for registering. I would just call the County Conservation Office. Platteville Farmers Market, Saturday, Roundtree Gallery, 120 West Main Street, Platteville, from 8 a.m. to noon. The market consists of growers, producers, and nonprofits that sell agricultural products as well as handcrafted art and prepared foods. Information, call 608-218-4374 or visit PlatvilleFarmersMarketWI.com. The Dubuque Winter Farmers Market, Saturday, Kennedy Mall, formerly the Yonkers Men's Store, 555 John F. Kennedy Road, 9 a.m. to noon. shop for local produce and other items indoors. More information about this event, wintermarketdbq.com. You have been listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the blind and print handicapped. And I have been your reader, Ken, reading from the Friday, March 5th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. Have yourselves a safe weekend and a nice weekend out there. No rain coming, so get out and enjoy some fresh air. It's supposed to be up in the 50s. We'll see where it goes. But until next week, take care.